Dr. Julie Weber. She is the youth politics expert at Illinois State University. She teaches a class on youth politics every year. And she has a book out called Beyond Columbine, School Violence and the Virtual. And so I had a chance to talk with Dr. Weber yesterday. We chatted about some of the implications and ramifications of some of these more recent youth protests that we've seen, such as the ones that took place right here in McLean County, even. And so I had a chance to talk with Dr. Julie Weber yesterday. Here's that interview. Thank you for joining me, Dr. Weber. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm trying to get a sense of what these youth protests mean for the future of youth activism. Close to home, recently we had a number of schools and a number of students schedule walkouts over gun violence. They were advocating for gun control. They highlighted the recent Parkland, Florida shooting. They took moments of silence to remember the 17 victims that were tragically taken in that instance. So is this a trend that we're seeing? Is this something that has happened before, or is this level of student protest relatively new?
This has happened in the past in the United States. It's been a while since we've had a youth movement like this. There were movements in the 50s, obviously, for civil rights in the South that were led by young people. Also, the ability to vote at 18 was changed from 21 by the 26th Amendment in 1971 because of prior protests in 1968, against the Vietnam War, and other issues, happening throughout the country. So, we've certainly had a lot of, youth activism in the past, but more recently there hasn't been much at all. So I am kind of inspired by this. But I do have some reservations about how it will eventually play out in the national conversation.
All right, you mentioned that you have both inspirations and reservations regarding these youth protests. Could you explain a little bit about what those might be?
Right. Since it is particularly the Parkland, the students from the Parkland School District that are Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, they published today their manifesto in The Guardian this morning. I assume that's to lead into the march tomorrow. I guess there's going to be over 800 marches throughout the world. And the major one will, of course, be in Washington, D.C. and in New York, Los Angeles. So there's several of them that are taking place all over the country. In fact, there's four in central Illinois that are going to be taking place on Saturday.
Wow.
So the Parkland students, the school newspaper, published this manifesto asking or making demands in the wake of the Parkland shooting. And many of them are very reasonable, I think, and they're good recommendations, but there's two in particular that kind of worry me.
And what would those be? What give you the stomach butterflies concerning this topic?
Okay. Well, the first one is, and one thing that I think I hear about in the media is that there's two main oppositions to young people doing this kind of activism. One is that children shouldn't be doing it anyway, the more conservative argument, right, that parents have rights over their children and that children should not be political actors until they're of age or old enough to understand the consequences. And then the other one is kind of a more political argument or one based on strategy, which is that do these students understand the other political actors that are involved in the process and how they might be swaying what they're saying? And so the first one that kind of worries me is they asked to change privacy law care providers to communicate with law enforcement. This is something that the police throughout the country have wanted for a long time, and this is also something that the Attorney General Sessions has also commissioned a study to do to look at how they can, what President Bush earlier called eliminate information silos, right? So what they're basically saying is that they would allow the police to violate HIPAA laws, which are mental health and health privacy laws. And that's very problematic to me because it gives the police sort of an inordinate power to decide the fates of individuals who may or may not be mentally ill, may or may not be taking medications, and suffering from various, you know, disorders and things like that. So it takes the autonomy away from people And the other component to this is that what then happens if the police can do this? If they know somebody is taking medication or is, in treatment for illness, and they think that the person is going to become violent, what then do they do? And in the case of Parkland specifically, it's been noted in the media that there aren't really any social services in Broward County. There's only the police, which is why the police were called to the home of Nicholas Cruz about 32 times, I think. So without a backup of some kind of, mental health structure in place, where are these people going to go? So if you change the privacy laws, you run the risk of taking rights away from many, many people who are not threatening at all in order to try and look for very few people who may or may not be a threat. So the other thing is that first thing I really want to mention and get in here is that it's highly unlikely that you're going to be shot at school. Children are probably going to be affected by gun violence in their home or either in a restaurant. So these shootings, while they seem like they're constant, they're not really happening always at schools, and they're actually very, very rare. So to have such a extreme policy be implemented because of something that we haven't actually determined is a real problem is kind of alarming to me. And we haven't had rates of violence. Actually, violence is on the decline. The highest rates of violence we had were in 1993 when they began to slope down. And that violence prior to 93 was because of the war on drugs. So this might actually serve to increase the amount of violence that we see in some ways. The other one that I kind of worry about is that they want to increase funding for school security. This is something that I think the National Rifle Association will welcome. And one reason is because school security will look a lot like what the NRA has proposed, which is hardening of school sites, right? So making them more militarized, making them less likely for an assailant to get in. And so I think that's worrisome, too. I can understand why many of the Parkland students feel this way. It's only been a month since the shooting happened. They're probably all grieving, and they're understandably feeling very afraid. So that makes sense to me in terms of where they're at right now, but it doesn't make sense to me in terms of a long-term strategy for dealing with gun violence. A better approach might be a public health approach, and so treating gun violence like smoking.
And in what ways do you think we can do that? Do we need more mental health training for teachers, educators, police officers, law enforcement, or just people in general? Because there might come a time when an average Joe will come across somebody who has a mental health need and needs some assistance.
Right. Definitely, in the public health approach, you would have many more therapists and counselors at school than we do now. School psychologists, for example, who might be able to identify individuals that are struggling and get them the help that they need, right? The other component to that is that you have to have the help that they need. So in the communities, you'd have agencies that were capable of helping people with problems work through these issues that maybe are not long-term, right? They wouldn't have them committed to a facility, but they would have them in a kind of alternative form of care that would be funded in the community. But as we see, we increasingly slash social welfare spending, and that means we have less mental health services and less community services for people to turn to if they wanted to help someone. So we need to increase that, I think, more than we need to think about hardening the school site, as the NRA suggests, or increasing funding for school security. It'd be better to secure the community, because oftentimes these folks aren't even in the school, right? Cruz wasn't even a student at that school at that time. And in the last 3 or 4 years, some of these major events have been older perpetrators that are no longer in school.
You mentioned a number of planned protests that are going to take place, not only in the state, but nationwide as well. So do you think that we are just going to continue to see a surge of politically active young students? And if so, do you think there are ways that they can assure that they are credible and that their voices will be heard?
I think that the thing that they could do is if they can pull this off, I think it's very important. If they can speak to their generation, if they can speak across class and racial lines about how their generation might vote in the future to try to disrupt the polarized politics that we have in Washington, D.C. Because what we've learned in the last few weeks is that some of the major impediments to even a reasonable gun control policy is special interest groups like the National Rifle Association, who are basically controlling Congress. They won't allow the CDC to do studies on gun rates or violence. And also to the voting to show these politicians that, you know, we're going to vote on our conscience. We're not going to simply not vote or continue to vote the same folks in that continue this kind of polarization in Washington. So if they can do that, if they can mobilize enough of their generation to make a difference in terms of who gets elected, then I think they can have a pretty serious impact.
Now, a couple counties over, students planned walkouts, but they faced some consequences, such as in-school suspension, detention for disrupting class. Now, do you think that some of these punishments can deter students from becoming more politically active, particularly in schools?
Well, I think if the protest doesn't affect the people in power in some way, then it's not going to be effective. In other words, if the schools are allowing them to walk out and protest, right, then the schools are fine with it, right? I think the schools probably are okay with this issue, too, because I think many of them probably don't want an additional job of carrying a gun to school or having an armed school. So I think, you know, they're probably on the same page with this issue. Now, were the students to start disrupting, which they're not allowed to do, the Supreme Court ruled on this in the 70s, and Tinker versus Des Moines is the case. There were two students, brother and sister, who wore black armbands to protest the Vietnam War. And the Supreme Court ruled 7-2 that students could express their political opinions in school as long as it didn't disrupt the school functioning. So walkouts might be perceived as disrupting, right? School functioning. So I'm not sure if they continue, then we might see some pushback on the part of schools. But I don't think that students should necessarily be worried about it because, as I said earlier, the only way political change really takes place is if those that are in power feel threatened. So it's not going to be easy, right? Some students may have to suffer consequences for their political activism.
You mentioned civil rights, the legal voting age being as reasons in the past why students have organized and protested, and now we're seeing more of a surge in gun control protests. So what are some other topics or issues that you think students will eventually organize either for or against?
Oh, there's tons of them. I don't know if they're certain about the world that they're going to be entering when they graduate, but one of the biggest issues that at least students who go to college face is increasing tuition rates and the student loan debt crisis. There's one issue. Another issue would be, you know, basically, for lack of a better way to say it, jobs in the United States, good paying jobs. We have people who are no longer even looking for work because they can't find good paying jobs with decent benefits. So I would also say that, you know, maybe they could come in on the myth of meritocracy because we have less and less opportunity for people to just sort of live a regular life and not have debt. So I think that there's plenty of things that they can, you know, if they can translate the kind of following that they get from this issue into other more enduring issues that they'll face when they go to college and they graduate and they want to enter the job market, and maybe not even just through voting, but through mobilizing their generation, I think that they can, there's many things for them to do. There's a lot of issues in this country that are not really being dealt with right now by the political class. So
in some ways it seems like the initiation for social and political change kind of falls onto the shoulders of these students.
Yeah, I think. I mean, I don't know if it falls to them because nobody else has done it, right? The problems have been there.
And it's more them taking up a mantle, perhaps taking up responsibility for themselves.
Right. Yes. And I mean, I'm just saying that, you know, I was inspired by this because I haven't seen my own generation, Gen X, and the generation that came after me was not necessarily very politically active. We didn't really have the numbers to be. And we also didn't have social media, which is one thing that they have now, I think, that really helps them increase their visibility and their message, is their ability to use social media in a very effective way. So I think that it's not just them that really needs to become more active on these issues. I think it's all of us to a certain degree that need to become more active and try and engage the national conversation with them. And as I say, you know, I mentioned those two issues on their manifesto, not because I want to be negative, but because I would like them to be aware that, you know what I mean, that when you're being political, there's always going to be pushback. And pushback is not necessarily bad. We learn from pushback. So I think that it's important for them to experience that and to have that kind of political experience. So I'm glad they're doing it, but, you know, like I said, there's always room for improvement.
All right. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Just wanted to reiterate that I think that we do need to think about the fact that violence has been declining and that it's probably highly unlikely that there will be more violence at schools like Parkland. So to put it into perspective is very important, I think, while we think about what kind of changes we want to see nationally.
All right, Dr. Julie Weber, expert of youth politics at Illinois State University. Thank you for joining me on Light, Live, and Local. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Julie Weber, the youth politics expert at Illinois State University. She teaches a class on youth politics every year and has a book out called Beyond Columbine, School Violence and the Virtual. All right, we're going to have to take a short break right now here at AM 1230 WJBC and WJBC.com, the voice of Central Illinois. It's 32 degrees at 826.